obligation to stand by what she had told the grand jury under oath in a court of law. Out of the blue, her mother, Esther, initiated a cat-and-mouse game with me about a month after Candy had testified. After being kicked out of the church, Bill Shapley was allowed back into the fold for the express purpose of making sure that his errant daughter didn't succeed in giving up the prophet. For Bill, it was a religious calling, and his salvation and status in the church was dependent on his success. For his obedience, he was given his wives and family back, all but Esther. Warren wouldn't allow her to be restored as one of the wives of the redeemed Bill Shapley. Over time, she explained to me why Warren had singled her out. She had been raped as a young girl by an older relative who had then piled enough guilt on her to make Esther think the assault was somehow her fault. She had never revealed that secret until Warren came to power, and then, in a fit of conscience initiated by Warren's incessant digging into the private lives of members, she had confessed everything to him. Instead of punishing the rapist, Warren considered Esther soiled from the contact and forbade her from rejoining Bill as a wife when he was allowed back in the church. Besides, she was past her childbearing years and had become a liability instead of an asset to the family. Instead, she was given a small widow's stipend and permission to visit with her other two daughters, who remained in Bill's custody, while she went to live in seclusion with a group of other such widows. Even those privileges would be at risk if she was disobedient, and Lyle Jeffs, Warren's brother, was her watchdog. Consequently, Esther also was conflicted about whether to defend and do what was best for her daughter Candy or please the FLDS authorities. A short time after our first meeting in a little park near Coral Canyon, the FLDS punished Esther by whisking away her daughters Annie, 13, and Billy, 16. The girls went willingly, but it was a clear message to Esther that Big Brother was watching, and her youngest children could and would disappear at any time if she didn't do as she was commanded and keep sweet about it. She was scared that she wouldn't see her children again, and she had written down the tag numbers of the Chevy Suburbans that had taken the girls away. She then quietly passed the plate numbers to me. I, in turn, passed those along to the FBI, who started to consider their options of how to deal with the situation. The FBI agents felt they needed to locate the two missing girls and place the entire crew of Esther, Candy, and the two younger sisters into the Federal Witness Protection Program. I was hoping Esther would be strong enough to take a leap of faith and leave the only life she had ever known. She agreed, and was about to take the plunge and go into the program. But just before the FBI was about to make the final arrangements, Esther backed down. She just didn't have the strength to turn her back on the cultural and religious ties that bound her to the only home she had ever known. This on-again, off-again contact went on for several months, before Esther called me urgently one evening in December 2005. She had a key to her ex-husband's insurance office and sometimes would sneak in there after business hours to call me without being overheard. One evening she called from there, worried that the FLDS was monitoring her movements. About 15 minutes into the call, she became nervous because there were people milling around outside, and they seemed to be checking out the building. Soon, they were banging on the doors and windows of the office.
"They're here! They're going to be coming in," she cried.
I worked out a quick code. Use the word notebook in a sentence if it was the police, and not just some God Squad enforcer who entered the room. Almost immediately, I heard a lot of noise, and then she said,
"Okay, I'll have to check my notebook and get back to you."
The crooked cops had her. An hour later, she called again, as calm as a summer pond, her words cryptic and machine-like.
"Hello. I'm not going to be talking to you anymore. I'm okay, and there's nothing to worry about. I am happy. Please don't bother me or try to call me."
I asked if anyone was listening to the call, to which she responded,
"Yes, I have to go."
And the phone went dead. 3 days later, the distraught Esther called yet again, asking if she could come by my office. Once inside, she told me that Lyle Jeffs, the prophet's strong-arm brother, had threatened to take away her widow's stipend and had warned that he was awaiting word on whether she would even be allowed back on FLDS priesthood property. That would have marked the end of her shelter and any means of support. She feared being left homeless and destitute. While we spoke, Lyle called on her cell phone. Esther went stone-faced, using her best, keep-sweet voice to repeat, "Yes, sir," 3 times. Then she said, "Thank you," and hung up. Lyle had just delivered the death blow that she would never be permitted to see her children again, and would not be welcomed back in the crick. Esther broke down and sobbed, talking of suicide and how to make it appear accidental. I offered help, but she just turned it away. All I could do was spend time with her and try to convince her that there was more to life than living under the rule of tyrants. She was inconsolable, a plague woman who was almost 60, on her own, with no home and no means of support, who now didn't even have her children to love her. Once again, there had been no due process of law and no mercy. Lyle was not yet finished. He was waiting the next morning as Esther approached her car after leaving the motel room where she ended up spending the night after leaving my office. He had been following her. This time, he dangled an attractive carrot under her nose. The prophet might be magnanimous enough to reinstate her in the church on probationary status and allow her to keep her stipend, as long as she would obey the priesthood in all things. What else could she do? Esther accepted Lyle's offer and became a tool to help control her traitorous daughter. I gained valuable insights in how ruthless the FLDS can be in response to a challenge, and the tactics they would use and great lengths they would go to threaten a witness. I wasn't sure that Candy would ever make it to a courtroom, but I hoped that, sooner or later, a stronger witness would somehow emerge. That moment was approaching faster than anyone expected. Alyssa Wall trusted us, but she had remained apprehensive of the process. She had been observing Candy's experiences, using them as a roadmap for what lay ahead. She wanted some protection against what we all feared, inevitable FLDS retaliation. Roger Houle, representing Alyssa, and Washington County Prosecutor Brock Belknap drafted a confidentiality agreement that would not only protect her identity, but would also allow her the freedom to withdraw from the action if the pressure became unbearable. As part of the camouflage, the prosecutor put off charging Alyssa's ex-husband, Alan Steed, with anything at all until after Warren Jeffs was arrested and tried. To name Steed prematurely would tip off the FLDS that Alyssa was involved. Alyssa's safety was more important than Steed. Under those conditions, she agreed to go forward. A civil suit accusing Warren Jeffs of placing an unidentified child in an illegal and incestuous underage marriage was filed under the pseudonym of M.J. on December 13, 2005. Not only were the initials fictitious, but the filing was made far away from Short Creek in Cedar City, Utah. The plaintiff sought damages from not only the prophet, but also from the FLDS Church and the UEP Trust. The lawsuit kept Alyssa so far in the background that there was little for the FLDS to track. 2 weeks later, on New Year's Day, 2006, Alyssa Wall did one of the hardest things a victim of abuse can do. During long interviews with detectives and attorneys from Washington County, Utah, basically a bunch of strangers, she relived her experiences in an outpouring that left her tearful and exhausted. Step by step, Alyssa grew more determined, and at the end, the authorities were convinced she was going to be a strong witness. On April 5, 2006, Alyssa Wall completed 2 more exhaustive interviews with the police and prosecutors, and Brock Belknap felt that he had heard enough. He hit Warren Jeffs with 2 felony charges of rape as an accomplice. The identity protection went to a higher level, when the prosecutor identified the plaintiff in this case as Jane Doe the Fourth. Only a handful of people knew that Alyssa, MJ, and Jane Doe the Fourth were the same person. The biggest dog in the hunt for Warren Jeffs was the FBI. The Bureau had been there all along, but they kept their support very quiet. Now, because Warren had crossed so many state lines so often, he was wanted as a federal fugitive in addition to being sought on the various state and civil charges. As 2006 dawned, the Bureau got into the game for real, bringing to bear their immense resources. A lot of these guys were friends of mine. We had a history of working together on other cases long before the FLDS investigation came along. I had helped them break up a ring of gem thieves, and I had assisted in a sting operation to catch a pedophile who had been preying on a 13-year-old girl, as well as several other cases. Over the years, I had learned to trust them and also had learned how to obtain their help and resources. When I approached them with an idea on how to put even more pressure on the Prophet, they were receptive. On June 27, 2005, the FBI issued what we call a UFAP, Unlawful Flight to Avoid Prosecution Warrant, for the arrest of Warren Jeffs, backed up with a reward of $50,000. Over the next year, Gary and I lobbied for even more federal help, and on May 6, 2006, the FBI bumped him up to the 10 Most Wanted list and doubled the reward to $100,000. Finally, the Prophet's words had been proven right. He was now among the elite of the international criminals being hunted by the FBI, right up there with Osama bin Laden. My popularity among the FLDS members had sunk to new lows in Short Creek over the past few months. When I walked into the Colorado City Mercantile Cooperative, the general store, I was always treated to an impressive display of mobile communication devices as cell phones were whipped out to report that the demon Gentile private investigator was back in the crick. Soon, a plague-rig convoy of trucks would show up on the streets, not just one, but six or eight. It was annoying. Then, the goons went too far. They decided to harass me at my home, something I would not tolerate. That spring, my wife mentioned that she had seen some pickup trucks with tinted windows pull into our driveway a couple of times and just sit there until our dogs barked at them. Then they would slowly back out and speed away. Since my house is situated on 20 acres at the end of a dead-end road that is 2.5 miles long, there was no reason for anybody to just happen to be coming out to our place unannounced. A few days after she told me about the trucks, she called me to the front porch. They were back. A pickup truck towing a trailer was idling in our driveway. Four people were in it. And when they spotted me, they took off. I jumped into my white SUV and we raced down the dirt road and then onto the highway, where I pulled up beside them and motioned for them to pull over. Instead, they tore along for another 8 miles until they swerved onto another dirt road, stopping only when it dead-ended at the DeMille turf farm. I boxed them in. Not knowing who they were, their intentions, or whether they were armed, I was reluctant to approach the truck, but they were just sitting there, so I stalked over and rapped on the driver's window until he rolled it down. Inside sat three buttoned-up men and one woman, who wore a typical fundamentalist prairie dress. It was the FLDS. "Hey, do you know who I am?" I shouted in the driver's face. All four looked down and refused to answer. I was furious. They had crossed the line by coming to my home, and it would not be tolerated. My face was now within inches of the man behind the wheel as I screamed again, "Do you know who I am?" The driver, staring down at the floor, shook his head that he did not. Then I asked the others, who did the same, so I cleared up the mystery for them. "I'm Sam Brower. Why were you at my house?" "Oh, we were just lost," the driver mumbled. I was seeing red. These thugs were invading my family home and needed a lesson fast. Listen, I told him. You come to my house again and trespass on my property, I'm going to splatter you all over my driveway. You understand? Go back and tell the people who sent you. You come to my house again, I will splatter you. Do you understand? They sat there not saying a word, and I wanted to make sure there was no misunderstanding. I reached in and knocked the baseball cap off the driver's head. It flew into the face of the guy in the back. You understand me? The guy quickly nodded his head and said he did. So if you were lost, why are you here? I demanded. We came here to buy some turf. The farm had just been mowed, and there were no rolls or strips of turf left except for little chunks. Okay. Get out and get your turf. While they started dutifully loading little scrap clods of soil into their trailer, I called a detective friend and told him what was going on. He said, Sam, get out of there before you do something stupid. I agreed. My goal was not to hurt anyone, just to humiliate them enough to make certain they had gotten the message. The church goons did not return. I had not seen Candy Shapley for some time when she contacted me in April 2006 and asked me to explain the latest legal wrinkle concerning her upcoming appearance in Kingman, Arizona, for the trial of her ex-husband, Randy Barlow. The Arizona subpoena for her appearance as a witness first had to be cleared through a Utah court hearing, which also required her to appear. I explained that it was just a formality to make the Arizona subpoena executable in Utah and explained the consequences of not appearing. But Candy was a no-show at the hearing, and the judge issued a warrant for her arrest on a charge of failure to appear. Once again, our star witness was gone. And this time she was a fugitive. Every cop in the nation had her name. Gary and I watched her home for more than a week, and finally spotted Esther driving up with someone else in the car. I trailed them for a while, but lost her when they turned into a fast food drive-thru. Esther Shapley wouldn't have gone to Candy's home just for the heck of it. Candy had to be nearby. Early the following morning, Washington County Deputy Matt Fisher, a savvy cop who had been on assignment in Short Creek for a year, decided to stop by Candy's apartment. She got there at nearly the same time, and she was arrested. Candy called her mother, Esther, from the jail to ask for help, without success. She then reached out to Gary and me. Ingalls was hamstrung because his jurisdiction was in Arizona, and Candy was in Utah. I agreed to help, but I demanded that she first tell me what had been going on. The truth. As I spoke to her in the Washington County Jail, a story of the FLDS luring her away from her home spilled forth. According to Candy, shortly after she had called me for advice about the Utah court date, her mother had summoned her. Esther had been babysitting one of the twins, and they made arrangements for Candy to pick up the child at R&W Excavation in Short Creek. That immediately sent up red flags for me, because R&W is owned by church enforcer Willie Jessup. Candy saw nothing unusual about that. Her uncle and aunt both worked there, as her mother also did on occasion, so she willingly went on over. She was surprised to find her father there, too, since Esther and Bill were still officially apart. And they were both wearing Gentile clothes, which was totally out of character. Then Willie Jessup pulled into the parking lot in a new blue GMC Denali and handed the keys over to Bill Shapley. It was all very strange. Bill and Esther urged Candy to climb into the truck with the twins so they could all go and visit some people in Phoenix. On the way there, Candy began asking questions, and they explained that the FLDS could not take the chance of her testifying against Randy, because that information could also be used against the prophet. The FLDS leaders needed for Candy to disappear, and had tasked her mother and father with the ugly job of kidnapping their own daughter and grandchildren.
Eventually, things will get back to normal and the prophet will find a good priesthood man for you.
Esther reassured her.
I don't want a good priesthood man,
Candy retorted.
I've already had one of those.
They ended up at a condo that Candy said belonged to another FLDS loyalist by the name of Paul Holm, where she was supposed to remain in hiding. But after a few weeks in Phoenix, her handicapped baby took a turn for the worse and once again needed urgent medical attention. Candy feared that if her little girl didn't receive specialized care back at Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City, the baby probably wouldn't make it. The FLDS phobia against using unfamiliar hospitals was ingrained in her. The new doctors would demand information. So a rendezvous was set up with another of Candy's sisters in Mesquite, Nevada, with the understanding that the sister would transport the child on to Salt Lake and Candy would sneak back into hiding. Once in Mesquite, Candy threw a public fit with inside of Gentiles. Her parents decided to avoid a scene by letting Candy go on to Salt Lake, too. Deputy Fisher found her the following morning. Now in jail, she was furious at her parents and the church for luring her and her babies away. As the father of two daughters and a son who I love dearly, I often struggle to understand how an FLDS mother and father can set aside normal parental instincts and knowingly place their underage daughter into a sexually abusive relationship with a man who might be decades older than the child. My youngest daughter was only 14 when I started working these cases, and the thought of such an event taking place involving one of my girls left me nauseated. I felt sorry for the things Candy had gone through. My heart went out to her, and every time I see one of those little girls in a prairie dress at the creek, I think about Candy's plight and that of many other young girls there and ponder the simple truth that they just don't stand a chance. They will never become a concert violinist or even play guitar with friends in their garage. They won't be physicists or chemists or help their own children with their geometry homework because they will never learn geometry themselves. Ambitions, goals, and achieving one's potential are limited to what a maniacal religious zealot lays out for them. The only thing on their horizon is bringing as many children as they can into the world to replenish the insatiable requirement for ever more wives and ever more children. I try not to dwell on that bleak future when I see the kids working in the summer gardens of Short Creek, but it's a hard image to flush from my mind. I suppose those feelings came to the surface when I called Esther and bluntly told her to get hold of Bill Shapley and get their daughter out of jail. It was their duty to help her out of this mess. Neither of them was aware at the time that I knew that their ruse had gone awry. Esther told me that she didn't have the money, and I snapped back that Bill certainly did. Esther promised to see if he would help. After a couple of hours, I called back. She claimed that Bill was unavailable. I was furious. A few years later, in December 2010, I came across a photograph in National Geographic of a kindly Bill Shapley watching some of his fully clothed daughters swimming in a mountain pond, where the photo seemed to portray a family having fun. All I saw was a devious father. I couldn't bear to watch Candy sit in jail, although the FLDS just might lure her away again or find some other way of keeping her quiet if she got out. The bail was $5,000, meaning that if she went through a bondsman, it would cost about $500, and a friend or family member would have to co-sign on the bond. None would, so I personally took care of it, carrying the liability if she didn't appear in court at the appointed time. That was never fully reimbursed. I told Candy that the time had come for her to do the right thing. As part of our deal, she had to let me know where she was in the future as the trial neared. The good part was that she was now extremely angry with her family and the church hierarchy. She told friends about how she had been lured away and held hostage. She told Gary and me the same thing. If she could keep that state of mind and keep focused on the truth, then I felt we had a chance. A short time later, Candy informed me that she had hired an attorney, something that few victims ever do.
Since I had been the one who had bailed her out, I knew Candy had little money. I therefore suspected that the FLDS may have supplied her with a lawyer. Her new attorney promised that henceforth, Candy would show up and testify. Chapter 29. Arrest. On her wedding day, July 27, 2006, Mary Ann Jessup was only 12 years and 24 days old. She had a blazing mane of bright red hair and a smile that reached across her freckled face from ear to ear. In the outside world, she would have been a sixth grader. When she was only 9, Warren Jeffs commanded her father, his loyal lieutenant Merrill Jessup, to fetch the girl to R-17 in Texas, where she could mature and begin receiving trainings on becoming a heavenly comfort wife for the prophet. Now the time had come, and Mary Ann was summoned by her mother, Barbara. She was told to hurry and clean up because something important was about to happen. After a shower, she put on a fresh set of the long underwear required by her religion and slid into baggy sweatsuit pants before adding stockings up to her knees. Her best dress, a simple garment with a pretty crocheted collar that buttoned modestly around her neck, came next. Her mother brushed the girl's long hair and fixed her plig do. Now, clean and dressed and with her hair appropriately styled, Mary Ann was escorted to a place she had never seen before, the inside of the temple of the YFZ compound, where she would be spiritually placed with 50-year-old Warren Jeffs as another child concubine. 1 minute the child had been out with other kids, and an hour later she was being sealed in marriage for time and all eternity to a fugitive who was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. The event was more than just another instance of Warren Jeffs grabbing up another preteen girl as a wife. It was a three-bride ceremony that gathered the FLDS elite into a power-sharing tribal ritual in which they intentionally bound themselves together in a criminal act with the exchange of underage girls who were called Daughters of Zion, one of whom was not yet a teenager. Slathered with a veneer of religious-sounding hocus-pocus to make it seem that it was all God's doing, the triple wedding was a sham, and each one was illegal. It was also a perfect example of the I'll-scratch-your-back-if-you-scratch-mine arrangement among the like-minded villains of the three-member First Presidency that ruled the FLDS. President Warren Jeffs, First Counselor Wendell Nielsen, and Second Counselor Merrill Jessup. The prophet knew he was pushing the envelope with the preteen Mary Ann, but he was a genius at getting others to share in the culpability of his crimes. The fathers and the mothers would all get their hands dirty right along with him. None could accuse another without implicating themselves. Bishop Merrill Jessup had contributed his 12-year-old daughter Mary Ann to marry the prophet. Warren Jeffs contributed one of his own daughters, Teresa, who had turned 15 the previous day, to marry 36-year-old Raymond Merrill Jessup, one of the bishop's sons, who was already a polygamist. Wendell Nielsen chipped in his own 15-year-old stepdaughter, Leanne, to be a bride of Merrill Leroy Jessup, aged 33, another of the bishop's sons. Family, fortunes, and fate were being knitted together in a huge criminal conspiracy. None of the girls had to be dragged to the altar. The children were filled with the belief that these marriages were good and pure, and they understood the prestige that would come from being placed with such important men. Wendell Nielsen said the opening prayer. Then Warren took over as presiding mouth, the authorized speaker, and performed the first two ceremonies. The prophet would happily report in his journal that he then made Merrill Jessup mouth, temporarily granting him authority, and assumed his place beside his petite bride-to-be for his own grotesque ceremony. The top of the diminutive Mary Ann's head came up to about the middle of the torso of her lanky husband, who stood 6'4". The marriage delighted him, and he exuberantly admitted one of his most heinous crimes to ascribe for the priesthood record. there was sealed Marianne Jessup to Warren Steed Jeffs. That's me.
Marianne was given to the care of Warren's favorite concubines, Naomi and Millie, for further training, and 2 weeks later the child was led to the ceremonial temple bed that had been designed to the prophet's specifications. There, she was sexually assaulted by the panting, praying Warren, assisted by Naomi and at least one other wife in a mockery of a loving marital union. The event was recorded on audio tape and later transcribed.
That feels good. Now repeat the words from your mouth. How do you feel, Marianne?
Warren prompted as he violated the little girl. A timid child's voice replied,
Feels good.
Ever obedient and keeping sweet. There is the sound of rhythmic, heavy breathing from the prophet, who then says,
Everyone else let go of me. Back away a little.
More hurried breathing and then some chanting gibberish is heard, and 5 minutes into this ceremony, he tells Marianne to prepare
for the greater light, the revelations of God on your behalf.
He has the women tie his hand to Marianne's, and then his gasping continues until a silence is noted and the ritualistic rape of a child is completed. The girl has hardly uttered a sound. Warren then issues long, tangled prayers for all involved and asks his little bride to come up and give him a hug. The child's innocence was gone forever. But we had not seen the last of little Marianne Jessup. A month later, on the night of August 28, 2006, I left my home in Utah and struck out on I-15 for the 5-hour drive down to Kingman, Arizona, to witness the trial of Randy Barlow, who was charged with raping young Candy Shapley. The breathtaking route cuts across Las Vegas and passes Hoover Dam and the Grand Canyon before bending back toward Kingman, but my mind was too preoccupied to enjoy the views. I could think only about how our mercurial witness would do the next day on the stand. Gary Ingalls had called to confirm that she was indeed going to show up, which was one problem solved, but what might happen next was up in the air. I checked into a small motel in Kingman about 9:30 p.m., had a bite to eat at a nearby restaurant, then climbed into bed and fell almost instantly asleep. It seemed that I had just closed my eyes when my cell phone rattled to life on the nightstand. I blinked awake. The amber numbers on the bedside clock showed that it was about midnight. I groped for the phone and answered, recognizing the excited voice of an FBI special agent from the Utah field office. I had worked closely with him over the years. He gave me the news.
They got him.
Got who? I stammered, still fuzzy with sleep.
Warren.
I sat bolt upright in bed.
You're shitting me, I blurted.
I wouldn't be calling you at midnight to shit you, he responded. It was a strange, surreally joyous moment. After all of the months and years and work, the demented prophet had finally been caught. Now it would not matter if he chose not to speak. The evidence and the witnesses would do the talking. Warren Jeffs' long ramble around America ended with a blind luck capture on I-15 outside the town of Apex, Nevada, 19 miles northeast of Las Vegas. Nevada Highway Patrolman Eddie Dutchover pulled up behind a new red Cadillac Escalade about 9 o'clock that night and could not make out the temporary license plate, which was obscured by a plastic cover. Warren had worried a long time about how overlooking some small detail could potentially trip him up, and it appeared that perhaps one of his revelations had actually come true. There were two men and a woman in the vehicle. The driver got out and handed over a Utah driver's license bearing the name of Isaac Jeffs, which sparked something in the officer's mind. It also stated that Jeffs had a concealed carry permit for a weapon, which earned a second, harder look at the driver, who was finding it hard to stand still. Dutchover approached the SUV again and spoke with the woman inside, who presented a license in the name of Naomi Jessup. Because nobody in the FLDS has the authority to perform legal marriages, Naomi still carried the surname of her father, Merrill Jessup. The trooper turned to question the second passenger, a lanky man sitting on the right side of the back seat,
staring straight ahead and eating a salad. The man studiously avoided looking at the policeman, and when asked for an ID, said his name was John Findlay. Asked if he had any written ID, such as a driver's license, the man produced a receipt from a Florida business for the purchase of contact lenses. Dutchover noticed that the big jugular vein in the long neck was pulsing wildly.
"You're so nervous it's making me nervous," the trooper said. "Is everything okay?"
He asked the uneasy passenger to also get out and made the two men stand apart while he continued to investigate. Their stories did not match. The driver, Isaac Jeffs, said they were headed for Utah, while the passenger, John Findlay, said Denver was the destination. Another red flag popped up when it was discovered that the big SUV was registered in the name of still someone else, a John Wayman out of Hilldale, Utah, and the two men differed on who Wayman was and why they were using his Cadillac. Dutchover was at a critical point, alert to the possibility that he was dealing with more than just a few tourists passing through the state. He was alone with three suspicious people at the side of a darkened interstate freeway, and one of them was licensed to carry a concealed firearm. Something was very wrong. These guys were acting like drug runners, but so far, he had nothing substantial against them except the unreadable temporary license plate. To further complicate matters, the computer had crashed at the Highway Patrol Dispatch Center, and the trooper had been unable to promptly run the registration. Had he been able to do so, and had it come back clean, he may have been forced to let the three people go on their way. But his training kicked in, and he kept them talking, even getting a signed waiver to search the vehicle, thereby maintaining control of the scene while waiting for backup and for the computer to recover. Dutchover remembered the photo of Warren Jeffs on the FBI's posters at the Highway Patrol headquarters, and the next trooper on the scene confirmed the likeness, but the tall guy kept insisting he was not Warren Jeffs. Another call got the FBI out there, and a lot more cops were on the way. When the troopers began searching the Cadillac SUV and found it filled with computers and other material that would certainly lead to the discovery of Jeff's true identity, further denial became futile. An FBI agent asked once again for his real name, and the pale, nervous man finally gave in.
"Warren Steed Jeffs,"
came the answer, with a sigh of resignation. The Federal Bureau of Investigation was not going to tolerate a mistake on this one. Earlier that very day, the authorities in Boulder, Colorado, had announced they would not file charges against an itinerant oddball named John Mark Carr, who had been arrested in Thailand and hauled to the States after making a false confession that he had murdered little beauty queen JonBenet Ramsey in 1996. The FBI had not been responsible for the Carr case, but the bungling of the Boulder District Attorney's Office had left a cloud hanging over law enforcement nationwide. Nobody wanted another mistake. The FBI was going to be sure of what they were doing. I spent a half hour on the telephone with the FBI as they tried to pin down Jeff's identity with certainty. They had him on the list, but neither they nor the Nevada State Police had day-by-day involvement with the case. By contrast, my life had been dominated by Jeff's and his cohorts for years. My office overflowed with documents, transcripts of old court cases, boxes of tapes, files, and folders, and thousands of hours of recordings of Jeff's droning lectures. My brain was just as full. I probably knew more about the FLDS than most members of the religion did. Without a doubt, this was the prophet. During the 2.5 hours they spent alongside that interstate highway, the authorities pulled an astonishing array of material from the cavernous SUV, everything a man on the run would need for survival: a police scanner, a radar detector, a couple of GPS navigational devices, a bunch of laptop computers, 3 iPods, better than a dozen cell phones and walkie-talkies, wigs, knives, and sunglasses, 27 bricks of $100 bills, each worth $2,500, about $10,000 worth of prepaid credit cards, a duffel bag jammed with envelopes that contained even more money, The keys to no fewer than 10 new luxury SUVs standing by to be exchanged as fresh vehicles whenever the old ones became too hot. A Book of Mormon and a Bible, and finally a photograph of Warren with his late father Rulon. The captured computers eventually would yield a trove of evidentiary material, including the audio tape of Warren having sex with Marianne Jessup. The police took a picture of a blank, emotionless Uncle Warren after he surrendered on the roadside. He was wearing baggy Bermuda shorts and a T-shirt, with short black socks and dress shoes. A loyal woman member of the FLDS would tell me later that the moment she saw that police photograph of him standing by the road, showing his flesh in shorts, she decided to bolt from the cult.
"It was the straw that broke the camel's back," she said. "It's not so much that he was dressed in clothes that he has kicked others out of their homes for wearing, but that he was wearing them and he had a tan."
Warren Steed Jeffs was taken to the FBI office in Las Vegas, and at 5:07 a.m., he was photographed, fingerprinted, and booked into the Clark County Detention Facility. The self-appointed prophet was now behind bars, but for some mysterious and frustrating reason, his traveling companions, Isaac and Naomi, had been questioned and released. That decision caught me off guard. Isaac and Naomi were apprehended in the same vehicle as one of the most wanted criminals in America, and for many months had been facilitating his continued freedom. I couldn't understand why they had not been charged with aiding and abetting a fugitive, obstruction of justice, and I am sure that, with a little head-scratching, there could have been a few more charges. They would most likely have been easy convictions and would have left both Naomi and Isaac facing serious prison time. Perhaps Isaac, the brother, would have stayed silent rather than help prosecutors, but Naomi was different. A shrewd manipulator and Warren's closest confidant, she may well have turned on him to save her own skin, in my opinion. The information she had would have been valuable beyond measure. While there was no way of knowing her role at the time, if she had been detained long enough to process some of the evidence found in the car, they would have discovered Naomi's importance. Instead, they let her go. It was a lost opportunity. A lot of potential evidence walked out the door when Naomi and Isaac were set free. To this day, I don't have an answer for why the feds did not seize that opportunity. An FBI agent who I asked about it later was as disgusted as I, hinting only that they had gotten orders from upstairs. It wasn't the first time, nor would it be the last time, that law enforcement agencies would make perplexing decisions in this investigation and never explain why. I was ecstatic that Warren had been caught, but it meant an almost sleepless night of phone calls and emails in my motel room in Kingman. I wasn't the only one awake. The news instantaneously swept through not only the FLDS and the refugee community, but the national media as well. By the time I walked through the grove of tall trees flanking the main entrance of the columned Mojave County Courthouse on the morning of August 29th, I was exhausted. Candy looked a lot better. She had long before rejected the FLDS dress code, and it seems that as soon as a woman leaves the cult and tastes that new-found sense of freedom, one of the first things she does is get a new hairdo and update the stale wardrobe. In her appearance before Superior Court Judge Stephen Kahn, Candy was a stylish 20-year-old young woman whose wavy red hair complemented the black pants, tailored vest, and black heels. Her mother, Esther, wore a drab brown ankle-length prairie dress and sat on the defense side of the courtroom, right next to the mother of the perpetrator on trial, Randy Barlow, in a silent show of solidarity. Barlow, whose bail had been posted by Willie Jessup, was facing two Class 6 felonies for sexual conduct with a minor, as well as the more serious charge of rape, because Candy had told the grand jury that he had raped her twice after she was forced to marry him when she was only 16. Barlow sauntered into court wearing jeans and a gray shirt, seemingly unconcerned for a man who could be sent away for several years in prison if convicted. I wondered if he knew something we didn't. Barlow was actually the second of 8 FLDS men who would be tried in Arizona's crackdown on underage marriages.
The first, Kelly Fisher, had been convicted and got 45 days in jail and 3 years of probation, a disappointing sentence. Judge Stephen Kahn's rationale for such a light sentence was that it was normal for a first conviction for statutory rape. The judge apparently didn't take into consideration the fact that Fisher was a loyal FLDS member and might well reoffend if called upon by his church leaders to do so. 5 of the 8 men indicted were eventually convicted. Soon after Candy took the stand, I had the sinking feeling that this trial was over before it even started. Only a few minutes into the general background opening questions from Mojave County Prosecutor Matt Smith, I saw Esther rise. She moved all the way across the courtroom and took a new position directly in Candy's line of sight, as if the witness was not already painfully aware of her complex family situation. The church hierarchy was using Esther to play on that weakness. It reminded me of something out of the Godfather movies. Smith asked Candy how she had learned she was being placed with Barlow. She remained cool and, after a long pause, looked right at him. I was stunned to hear the words that followed from her mouth. "I have nothing else to say," she told the prosecutor. I cringed, almost able to hear Warren Jeff's "Answer them nothing" mantra rolling around in her head. Smith had not expected such explicit opposition. Everything he had was flying right out the window as the prime witness and victim deliberately defied the court. He pressed forward and she became adamant and her stare hardened. "I have nothing else to say." Judge Kahn instructed her to respond or face the possibility of contempt of court. Candy remained firm. "I am not willing to answer any more questions." She crashed and burned before our eyes. Following the courtroom disaster, the state tried to salvage something from the wreckage. There was a little more legal wrangling, but it was over. After Candy balked, the man who she claimed under oath had savagely raped her walked out of court a free man. It was unbelievable. She was ruled in contempt of court and sent to a shelter for abused women on a 30-day sentence. It was later shortened to 2 weeks when Matt Smith felt there was no need to continue victimizing the victim. Having gotten to know Esther, I was not surprised by her strange actions. The church leadership had backed her into a corner, and I didn't expect her to have the courage to defy them. But I was highly disappointed with Candy. At least she didn't lie. She just refused to answer. The charges against Warren in Arizona remained in place, but if Candy would not even testify against Barlow, there was no chance that she would take the stand against the prophet. Of the other 3 Arizona men who ended up not being convicted of the charges against them, Rodney Holm, the former deputy marshal, remains a convicted felon and registered sex offender in the state of Utah. His Arizona charges were dismissed. The indictment against Terry Barlow was dismissed, and Donald Barlow was acquitted. I wouldn't allow Candy's and Esther's performances in court that day to alter my relationship with either of them. I never burn my sources, no matter how frustrating. Who knows what the future might hold?
Chapter 30. Guilty. Warren Jeffs, wearing a dark blue prison uniform that drooped over his skinny frame, had his initial appearance in court before Las Vegas Justice of the Peace James Bixler on Monday, August 31st. Arizona and Utah had agreed that Utah would try him first because it had the stronger case and the charges there were more serious. 2 first-degree felony counts of rape as an accomplice. Warren was not represented by a lawyer at that initial hearing, and when Bixler asked if he would fight extradition, the prisoner answered in a soft voice that he would not. The following day, he was transported by a Utah Department of Public Safety helicopter over the 150 miles to the Purgatory Correctional Facility in Hurricane, Utah, and within 24 hours, he was on a closed-circuit television loop for a 6-minute hearing before Judge James L. Shumate, who set a hearing for September 19th. By the time of that preliminary hearing, Jeffs had legal representation, a Salt Lake lawyer named Walter Bugden, and the identity of the plaintiff, the fictitious Jane Doe IV, was legally revealed to him. It was Alyssa Wall. A number of Warren's FLDS followers were in the courtroom. He occasionally stole a glance at them, pleaded not guilty to the charges, and was ordered held in Purgatory Correctional Facility without bail. After being on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list for more than a year, he was thought to be a considerable flight risk. While Bugden would be the local counsel in Utah, celebrated Las Vegas defense attorney Richard A. Wright was hired to be the overall honcho for what we called the beauty show of Jeff's well-tailored and well-coiffed lawyers. FLDS legal costs had been huge before Jeff's was arrested, and now the price tag had to be skyrocketing. In our country, every defendant is entitled to a fair trial and a lawyer, and some attorneys specialize in the high-profile defense arena, where the money is good and the spotlight is bright. Wright was described in the Las Vegas Sun newspaper as having been involved in some of the biggest legal cases in recent Las Vegas history. Gamblers, a boxer, murderers, and a grandmother, all with low-key aplomb. He was so good that he managed to win a sentence of life in prison instead of the death penalty for a man who raped and murdered a 9-year-old girl whose body was found in a casino bathroom with the entire crime caught on security video. Wright also did some work in 2008 for Antoine Tony Rezko, a Chicago political hack known to associate with the mob who ran up hundreds of thousands of dollars in markers and debt to several of the best casinos in Vegas, while also being entangled in political corruption and influencing peddling charges back in Illinois. The Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice had named Wright the defender of the decade in the year 2000. While awaiting his preliminary hearing after arriving at Purgatory, Warren Jeffs was escorted from his cell to see a visitor, just as another prisoner was brought out. They recognized each other instantly, and Warren called out,
"Is that you, Doyle Dockstader?"
Dockstader, a tough survivor of the prison system who was then charged with assault and other crimes, became unhinged at the sight of his former Alta Academy headmaster.
"I haven't forgotten you,"
Uncle Warren said as they passed in the jail hallway, both under guard.
"I can't describe it," the shaken prisoner told me later. "All the things he had done to me just started coming back."
Two nights later, Dockstader climbed a fence of the prison exercise yard and escaped, shredding his skin and clothing on the sharp concertina wire in his determination to flee. After a couple weeks on the run, he was captured in Las Vegas following a chase in which he rammed a police car while trying to get away. The shock felt by Dockstader concerned me. Almost from the start, there had been side trails in my investigation that reeked of insidiousness and mystery. Individually, they might be dismissed as foggy memories, old wives' tales, or simple overreaction, but combined, they formed a frightening picture. While the stories might never rise to the standard of proof required in a court of law, it would be imprudent to ignore them. Here was a man who had an actual army made up of thousands of people who were blindly obedient to him. I heard one bluntly state, "I would cut my wives' throats if the prophet called upon me to do so." Warren's belief that the church should practice blood atonement was only the tip of the problem. I had been told by several former students at the Alta Academy of how the headmaster had required what he called survival classes to help prepare them for the day when the streets of Salt Lake City would run with the blood of the wicked. Those classes were taught with the help of the feared D. Jessup, who would personally demonstrate how to cut the throats of an assortment of animals and butcher them in front of the school children. Stories were commonplace of senior girls at the academy being required to slit the throat of a sheep in order to graduate. Nobody ever forgot the great slaughter of the dogs in Short Creek. There were hidden caches of guns and explosives around FLDS enclaves. Selected men underwent specialized military-style firearms training at a paramilitary camp in Nevada. Warren had constantly carped about God's imminent judgments wiping the Gentiles from the face of the earth and had toured the entire country praying for the destruction of whole cities. The religion itself was founded on the principle that its members were above the laws of the land. It was never much of a leap to believe that despite their protestations to the contrary, the FLDS had the means and the will to do something horrible. The question of whether the prophet's grip on the faithful would remain strong while he languished in jail actually was easy to answer. The people had already been conditioned to the prophet running their world from the back seats of luxury cars prowling the highways of the United States. Doyle Dockstader knew exactly what Warren Jeffs was capable of and may have been the only prisoner to fear the gangly misfit. Other inmates regarded him as just another child molester who had gained notoriety by talking a lot of religious mumbo-jumbo and had a group of brainwashed followers. The jail's land shark showed no mercy. Child molesters are at the bottom of the prison food chain. Although confined to his own cell and out of the reach of other inmates, he was ridiculed and taunted from a distance. The nonstop noise and foul language and the aggressive nature of the prisoners was completely foreign to the delicate sensibilities of the soft, clumsy man. Jeff's mental state began deteriorating from the moment the steel doors had slammed shut behind him for the first time. He had been thrust out of his element, and the shock of not being in control of every aspect of his life and the lives of those around him soon gave way to the rude awakening that he was no longer an extraordinary being. In prison, he was just another convict. In Utah, there is no insanity defense. If found mentally incompetent to stand trial, those charged are detained in the criminal section of the state mental hospital until deemed capable of understanding the charges and participating in their own defense. Psychologists were hired to evaluate Jeffs, but he answered very few of their questions and would not participate in their diagnostic tests. The official prognosis was that although he was mentally ill and depressed, he was competent to participate in the proceedings. He could stand trial. The preliminary hearing in Utah was an on-again, off-again affair that got underway on November 22nd and ended on December 14th, 2006. Then his attorney deluged the court with appeals, fighting hard even in this most routine of legal steps. All the while, his client remained locked up in his little cell. He was having a tough time in there. As the days turned to weeks and then months passed, Warren's condition continued to slide. He summoned all the rituals he could concoct to make sure that his 6x10 cell was spiritually clean and pure, so that God could come and visit and provide revelations. He awoke several times each night to rededicate the tiny chamber all over again. He prayed so long that his knees became herniated and bled. Some of the jail staff made bets on how long he could stay kneeling before toppling over. Unable to control his compulsions, and despite knowing that he was being viewed through the video cameras, the prophet masturbated so frequently that the guards continually reprimanded him. He ignored them. As he teetered on the brink of fantasy and reality, any doubt that he was out of control vanished the day he stood at one end of his cell and ran full tilt and head first into the wall at the other end, repeatedly. He would later attempt to hang himself with his pajamas, which resulted in trips to both the hospital emergency room and the psych ward. The judge was unable to clear away the blizzard of defense motions and make his final ruling until 5 months later, on May 28, 2007. By then, Warren was a physical and emotional mess. Although he wore a neat dark suit, white shirt, and white tie, he was so gaunt that the shirt collar hung loose around his scarecrow neck. During the proceedings, he would sometimes nod off, drooling to the point that his shirt grew wet.
His condition had been a problem for the prosecution. They wanted to make sure Jeffs was capable of participating in his own defense. To maintain his delicate mental balance, the jailers had pampered him. He was allowed nearly unlimited telephone access and a constant stream of visitors. He participated in long-distance worship services, led teachings from a payphone, and wrote new revelations and letters to be passed along to his followers. He assigned code numbers to specific individuals in the church hierarchy because he knew his conversations were being monitored and recorded while in custody. He was still building Zion from his jail cell and was still able to keep a tight rein on his followers. They firmly clung to the idea that the government was persecuting the prophet and church only because of their unpopular religious beliefs. In this, they were immovable. Warren was still captain of their ship, steering them all to salvation in the hereafter. Jeffs made every effort to conduct business as usual, and he almost succeeded. Almost, but not quite. He was out of his element and missed the comforts and pampering he enjoyed as the FLDS monarch. The jail's medical staff made a point of dropping by just to talk to him, and he was allowed a special diet to help stave off his weight loss. A regimen of medication was prescribed to treat his depression and stabilize him, but he usually would not take it, saying the government was trying to poison him. He had some disturbing revelations during the Lord's visits at night. Among his dreams was the sad prediction that his Naomi, who he referred to by the code name 91, was about to die. Warren dispatched orders to prepare her funeral arrangements, designated who would speak, and indicated where she should be buried. He spent hours in his cell communing with the heavens concerning Naomi's mission in the hereafter. It would have been a stunning illustration of his prophetic powers, except that it was all just another manifestation of his psychosis. Warren spent a long week mourning his loss before learning that Naomi remained alive and well. At the conclusion of the hearing, after finally binding the prophet over for trial, Judge Shoemate was taking care of a few housekeeping legal matters and getting ready to recess. Suddenly, Warren stood at the defense table and said, "May I approach the bench, Your Honor? I just need to take care of one matter." Awkwardly scrawling on a white tablet, he stood to speak and was fumbling to tear off a piece of paper to present to the court. The judge glanced up, surprised, and immediately denied the request, instructing Jeffs to take up whatever it was with his lawyers. To allow the prisoner to start talking directly to the court and not through his attorneys risked jeopardizing the entire process. Shoemate scowled at the defense lawyers, who closed in around their client to see what he was talking about. "I just have this one matter. It will only take a minute, Your Honor." Warren sputtered, gesturing with a sheet of paper. "This will just take a minute." At that instant, a news photographer snapped his shutter. Shoemate barked, "Court is recessed," and almost bolted from his own courtroom while the lawyers scrambled to take away the paper and keep their client under control. The picture was distributed to the media, but it gave no clue as to what Warren wanted to talk about. Photography is an important part of my work, and I wondered if there might be some way to digitally discover what was on the other side of that paper. I obtained a good copy and got busy with my computer enhancing and enlarging. Whatever Warren had written became faintly visible on the back of the sheet. Of course, the writing appeared backward in the snapshot, so I made a mirror image, then zoomed in. As I sharpened it and filled in the pixels, some of the words became clear. He had written, in part,
"I have not been a prophet, and am not the prophet."
He had intended to announce to the court that he was not the prophet of the FLDS after all. Ben Winslow, a reporter with the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, had called while I was working on the image, and I gave him the information. Ben jumped on it, enlisting the help of a photography lab and a handwriting expert.
Winslow's story, headlined, "I Am Not the Prophet," spread to the national media. Judge Shumate had not allowed Jeffs to make his statement in court, but outside the courtroom,